Pico Iyer was born to Indian academics teaching at Oxford University. He was educated at a British private school, and then at Oxford itself, and then after that he did graduate studies at Harvard in the United States. After that, at a very young age, he became a lecturer at Harvard University, and after that became a foreign correspondent for Time magazine, covering countries as diverse and as far and wide as Ethiopia to Paraguay. He currently lives in rural Japan with his Japanese partner. So perhaps more than anybody else, he understands what life is like in the global village. And he wrote this: "The world is filled with new kinds of beings as well as new kinds of realities. Rwandans living in Auckland, Moroccans living in Iceland. One reason why Melbourne looks ever more like Houston is that both of them are filling up with Vietnamese pho cafes. Everywhere is so made up of everywhere else that I hardly notice that I'm sitting in a Parisian cafe just outside Chinatown in San Francisco, talking to a Mexican-American friend about biculturalism, while a Haitian woman stops off to congratulate him on a piece he's just delivered on TV about St. Patrick's Day. And she says to him in a thick patois, 'I know all about those Irish nuns,' she says, as we sip our Earl Grey tea near signs that say, 'City of Hong Kong, Empress of China.' Never before have we lived cheek by jowl with so many different cultures. And London is a case in point." I mean, that could have described London as much as San Francisco or Melbourne. "As for that matter is our church here at All Souls, with all our diversity and different cultures, even within this building. We live in a plural culture, and I love it. It's great. We all have to get along, though. And somehow we've got to find a way to accept our differences. So how on earth do we do that? Well, there's just one word for it: tolerance. That's our subject tonight, tolerance. We're all different, so we've just got to enjoy, relish, make the most of our differences. Respect those differences. Tolerate those differences. And that makes perfect sense. And I, for one, am very grateful for living in a modern, tolerant society. Just look at some of the news items from this week. A Christian archbishop kidnapped and murdered in Iraq by Al-Qaeda operatives. Or the story of Mehdi Kazemi, a gay 19-year-old Iranian whose boyfriend was hanged 2 years ago and who has lost his asylum appeal and faces repatriation to Iran, where he faces certain death. Apparently, since Iran's Islamic Revolution in 1979, 4,000 gays and lesbians have been executed. Did you know that? It's appalling. It's a kind of madness. I'd even go so far as to say it's intolerable. But there's the catch, you see. Make tolerance your battle cry, and you quickly find you must be intolerant about intolerance. Now, you might think that's okay. But already we've discovered that things are not quite as simple as we might like. Well, you'll commonly hear claims, and I guess the media is full of these, claims that actually it's religion that is to blame. After all, those two stories about Islamic fundamentalism. But of course, Christians aren't squeaky clean either. We don't have a perfect track record. And then, of course, there are those rather tricky bits in the Bible. And tonight's passage about a stoning for adultery is at best pretty alarming. No wonder people want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. The strident atheist Christopher Hitchens put it bluntly. He said, "Religion poisons everything." But this week of events, as we've been hearing already, the service, as it comes to an end at All Souls, it's come under the banner of 3D life in perspective. And I do want to suggest that we need a little bit of perspective here. You see, it's just not possible to blame religion exclusively. Let me give you some stats. The Spanish Inquisition executed 2,000 people over a period of 350 years. In New England, the Salem witch trials executed 25 women. But of course, there were the Crusades, which spanned over 200 years or so, and it's estimated that perhaps as many as 6 or 7 million died during those 200 years because of the Crusades, with Muslim and Christian casualties roughly coming out at half each. And then there are, of course, the contemporary religious conflicts that people like to appeal to. What's happened over many years in Northern Ireland or Iraq or Palestine? But I suspect we have to realize that they have as much to do with ethnicity and culture as they do religion. But the fact stands. Now compare and contrast that, those statistics, with the atheist ideologies of the 20th century. Hitler's regime exterminated between 11 and 14 million people, including 6 million Jews, in just 12 years. Stalin's regime led directly or indirectly to the death of between 20 and 30 million in just 30 years. Pol Pot's regime, around 2 million Cambodians in just 5 years. Now, please do not misunderstand me here. I am not claiming that religion is better because it kills fewer people. I think it's terrible that religion should be the cause of even one death. Let me make that quite clear. And especially if the Christian religion is the one to blame. And a Christian church history is, for a number of reasons, a cause of profound shame. All I'm saying is that it's not fair to pick on religion as the only poison in our world. Therefore, it's common at this point to suggest another problem. And it's not religion or no religion. The problem is having an ideology in the first place, a belief system, full stop, whether it's religious or secular. That's what people are saying these days. Get rid of the lot. Or at least, if you've got a worldview or an ideology, just keep it to yourself. That's the way we can get along. We need tolerance. I mean, that's the only way, in fact, that tolerance is held to be possible, isn't it? Look, just keep your beliefs to yourself. Sounds reasonable. Very reasonable. Here we are in a city of 7 or 8 million with over 100 different languages spoken in London with all kinds of different worldviews. You name it, it's here. We've got to get along. But again, it's not quite as simple as that, is it? This is what the brilliant novelist Dorothy L. Sayers said over 70 years ago. It could have been written yesterday. This is what she said. In the world, it's called tolerance. But in hell, it's called despair. The sin that believes in nothing, cares for nothing, enjoys nothing, lives for nothing, and remains alive because there's nothing for which it would die. Is our ideology then to be that there should be no ideologies? Are we to tolerate everything except intolerance? Well, I suspect that our culture has tied itself in knots over tolerance, and doesn't actually know how to unravel them. So I think we need to make three careful distinctions here. The first is we need to understand a tolerance of ideas. We've got to ask the question, do all ideas have equal validity? It's got to be asked, isn't it? When we say we want to be tolerant, are we honestly saying that we have to tolerate every single idea, or suggestion, or opinion? Is there no such thing as a false statement? I'm not even asking the question how we know whether something is a false statement or not. I'm just simply asking, is there such thing as a false statement? Or do we simply shrug and say, well, it doesn't really matter that much? How about the idea of flat earth? Or that 2 + 2 = 7.5? Or that all religion is always poisonous. Is that fair? Or even that all religions are really the same underneath. Is that true? It's not what Joe's friend found as she was dying. So we've got to be understanding, we've got to be careful about a tolerance of ideas and understand what we mean by that. Secondly, there's a tolerance of behavior. Does tolerance mean that we should let everyone get on with their lives in private, that they should just be allowed, or rather they have a right to do whatever they want, undisturbed? Is that how we can best get along in this great multicultural city? Seems particularly reasonable, doesn't it? But what if behind closed doors they're actually beating up their spouse or abusing a child? Most sane people would not tolerate that behavior. So I guess people then say, oh, well, it's a question of tolerating any behavior so long as it doesn't affect or harm somebody else. But you see, you're already having to draw lines, aren't you? Get this from the unpredictable candidate for London Mayor, Boris Johnson. Now, please note that I am not quoting him as part of some party political broadcast. But here he is in characteristically robust form, talking about the Taliban's attitude to women's education in Afghanistan. This is what our dear Boris said. It's time for concerted cultural imperialism. They are wrong about women, we are right. We cannot have them blowing us up. The deluded fanatics must be helped to a more generous understanding of the world. Do you disagree with that? I would have thought people on all corners of the political spectrum, left and right, would have to concede agreement there, don't you think? You see, we cannot escape the fact that we need boundaries. We need to draw lines somewhere. The question is where? And the question is who gets to draw those lines? So far, so good. But there is a final area of tolerance that gets far too easily overlooked. We've thought about tolerance of ideas, about tolerance of behavior, but what about tolerance of people? You see, the issue is, after you've worked out who gets to draw the line, and after you've worked out where the line should be drawn, the issue is, what do you do with people who are different, who think differently, who are on the other side of the line? What do you do with them? How do you handle them? How do you treat them? The problem comes clear when we understand, I think, how ideas of tolerance have changed fundamentally in our culture. It used to be the case that tolerance was directed at people, not their ideas. So the line went something like this. I may absolutely detest the things you say, but I'll defend to the death your right to say them. I may detest the things you say, but I'll defend to the death your right to say them. In other words, you could only prove you were tolerant of someone when you actually disagreed with them. Do you see that? If you disagreed with them on some point, then you could prove you tolerated them. You don't tolerate someone you totally agree with. That's not tolerance, that's being a friend. That's being in total agreement. But tolerating someone that you disagree with, well, that's the entire basis on which an ethic of free speech is based. But I think things have changed, and I think it's quite worrying. It's now the case that people themselves are the ones who are not tolerated. Not only are their ideas banned, but they themselves find themselves banned as well. Those who challenge this and question this new form of tolerance find a fierce intolerance directed against them and not simply against their views. And that is a very different ball game, and I might suggest it marks the end of free speech, and in fact, if we're not careful, the end of true tolerance in society. Now, at last, we come to the Bible. So please do pick up the Bible and to turn to John 8. Because you see, I think what we find, having understood all of these sort of things that are floating on in our culture, that's part of the oxygen that we breathe if we live in the West, we will find Jesus at his subversive and shocking best, and yet at the same time at his most wonderfully attractive. He shocked his contemporaries, and I'm pretty sure he's going to shock you too. And there are two particular things that we see, firstly, in this passage. And the first is that Jesus is intolerant of hypocrisy. He's intolerant of hypocrisy. And I don't know if Candy was reading it to you, whether you picked up that the whole scene has the air of a lynch mob with its violence and simmering hatred. But these were meant to be the religious good guys, those who lived the life and taught the truth. These teachers of the law, these Pharisees, they were the respectable ones. But in this sordid scene, they seem to have dragged a woman, half-dressed and out of her wits with terror, into the temple courts. And she's just a tool for them, a link in their cat-and-mouse game. In fact, one commentator called them the Get Jesus Committee. For as we can see there in verse 6, do you see down there? They were using this question as a trap in order to have a basis for accusing Jesus. Now that in itself is pretty despicable, isn't it? This poor woman was just a pawn, as so many vulnerable women in human history have been, pawns in the hands of powerful men. And after all, adultery takes two to tango, so to speak. Where was the bloke? If these guys, if these leaders were really serious and concerned about adultery, as they claim to be, well then surely the bloke should be in the dock as well. No, they weren't interested in him. They weren't interested in this woman, actually, either. They were out to get Jesus. The Get Jesus Committee at work. But hang on a minute. You see, the slightly tricky thing is that these lawyers and Pharisees seem to have had a point. Look at verse 4. They say, "Teacher." That's pretty sickening, isn't it? I mean, despite the show of respect for Jesus in calling him teacher, respect was the last thing on their agenda. It's smarmy to the core. "Teacher, this woman was caught in the act of adultery. In the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. Now, what do you say?" Okay, here we go. This is religion at its worst, at its ugliest, most poisonous. Because, you see, this lynch mob had a Bible text to lean on. And it is true that capital punishment was a reality in the Old Testament. It is true. And it is true that adultery was on the list. We can't escape that. As are a lot of very surprising and often disturbing things on that list. We can't shy away from that. But we must bear in mind two things here. We must understand the nature of punishments in the Old Testament. You see, punishments in the Old Testament were not necessarily mandatory, but they marked the upper limit for sanctions. They were designed to indicate the seriousness of specific sins. Now, you might not find that very helpful, but we do need to understand that is the case. And there are a lot of things to unpack there. I mean, after all, you might not think, well, adultery is not that bad, is it? Well, I'll come back to that in a moment. But more importantly, it is quite clear that by Jesus' day, stonings did not happen. For a start, they lived under Roman occupation. And the Roman authorities would have taken a very dim view indeed of such activity, since it would have completely undermined their authority. You can't have mob rule in the streets. You can just hear the governor saying, can't you? Stonings did not happen in Jesus' lifetime. Certainly not in the big cities. And so the whole thing actually was a trap. Well, we've already discovered that. But do you see what sort of dilemma Jesus found himself in? If he had said, don't stone her, they would be able to come back straight away and show that he undermined the authority of the Bible. And thus would have given them grounds for arresting him, perhaps even executing him there and then, who knows. But if Jesus did say, you can stone her, he would both lose his popularity and credibility and found himself in rather hot water with the Romans. It's a brilliant trap, isn't it? I mean, the Get Jesus Committee, they've gone on overtime with this one. Ingenious. What Jesus did next was both mysterious and ingenious. He just started writing in the sand. You see, look down at verses 6 and 7. And it drove the lawyers completely mad. Can you imagine? I mean, no lawyer likes to be ignored. And to add insult to injury, he's just there doodling. Now, we've got absolutely no idea what was written. All kinds of commentators speculate as to what he was writing or drawing or doodling. Who knows? But his tactic was brilliant. Well, whatever he was writing, what he said, what he comes out with next, was one of the most famous things he ever said. Let's have a look down at the passage. Verse 7. If any one of you is without sin, let him be the first to throw a stone at her. And then he gets back to his doodling. The Get Jesus Committee is reduced to total silence and shame. Jesus is clearly the one in command here, isn't he? And then look at verse 9. It's amazing. At this, those who heard began to go away one at a time. The older ones first. The storytelling is vivid, isn't it? It has the ring of truth. Don't you just love that detail? The longer we live, the more we've got to hide. Don't you think? The older ones slope off first. You see, you can't say one thing and do another. Not only did Jesus show his mastery and save this woman's life, but he also exposed the rank hypocrisy of these religious leaders. I mean, in fact, hypocrisy in any leader is pretty intolerable, don't you think? After all, isn't that why the governor of New York had to resign on Wednesday? Eliot Spitzer had portrayed himself as a moral, crusading attorney general and then was elected last year as governor, taking on Wall Street corruption and organized crime, which included prostitution rings. And he was then caught spending literally thousands of dollars on high-class prostitutes himself. He had to go. Such double standards are not acceptable in public life. They're not acceptable. Do you know Christians who claim the moral high ground but live as lowlifes? Do you know people like that? Well, they're perfectly respectable when they meet in public, but actually they're very different people in front of their computers on the internet. Doesn't that stick in your throat? That hypocrisy? Well, if so, you can be sure on that point that Jesus is on your side, not theirs. He cannot stand hypocrisy. And nor should he. But what Jesus does next is both wonderfully liberating and profoundly politically incorrect. For sure, he speaks to the woman as a vulnerable and terrified human being. Did you notice that? I mean, he's the first person in the story actually to recognize her as a person and talk to her. But then we see something more. You see, we've seen him intolerant of hypocrisy, but we also see him intolerant of wrongdoing. Everybody slopes off, and only Jesus was left with the woman still standing there. And in verse 10, we see that he straightened up and spoke to her. He said, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" "No one, sir," she said, trembling. What's he going to say? "Then neither do I condemn you." It's an amazing moment. Just thinking about it gives me goosebumps. "Then I don't condemn you either." But while we might think that that is just fantastic and way ahead of its time, our modern tolerant ears just wish he'd stop there. But Jesus didn't. Do you see what he then said? "Go now and leave your life of sin." Oh, why did he have to go and blow it with that? Do you see, Jesus had drawn a line. He says he doesn't condemn her, but that does not imply he thinks she's innocent. He knows she's not. She knows she's not. And adultery was definitely on the wrong side of the line. Now, perhaps you think that's outrageous. Perhaps you think that what we do in our private lives has nothing to do with our public lives. Perhaps you might think that that's precisely where religion should just butt out of people's lives and let them get on with it. Who does Jesus think he is anyway? Did the adultery affect him? Well, the simple answer is that Jesus knows best how to live in this world because he made it. Seems crazy, doesn't it? He knows how damaging sexual immorality can be, both for those immediately involved and those further afield in families, in different generations. Because in one sense, there's no such thing as a private misdemeanor. It always has impact in all kinds of unexpected and uncomfortable ways. But again, in another sense, I guess we can just leave the adultery thing for one side, because I don't suppose it really matters what the particular issue was at stake here. It could have been anything. For we all cross the line that God has drawn at some point or another, all of us, myself included. I do not claim perfection as I stand up here. Far, far from it, to speak to my family. Because you see, we all live in God's world as if it was ours and not his. And the key thing to notice as I come to a close is that yes, Jesus has drawn a line. But he also loves those who are on the wrong side of it. Even if he finds their ideas or their behavior simply unacceptable, he does not find them as individuals unacceptable. It was a bit like what Jo was saying about her brother, wasn't it? How he didn't judge her. But he kept on saying there's something more. There's something more. Something better. And if you read on in John's Gospel, you'd see how much better the story really gets. Because Jesus went on to prove his absolute commitment to those who are on the wrong side of the line. And as we've already mentioned, this is the beginning of Easter week. Next weekend is the Easter weekend, and on Friday we remember it as the day that Jesus was executed on a cross. And as he hung there on a cross, he said of those banging the nails into his arms, "Forgive them, because they've got no idea what they're doing." Why did he go to that cross? He did it so that people on the wrong side of the line that he'd drawn could be forgiven, could be restored, could be renewed. He takes the punishment that we all face on himself. And that poor, terrified woman in John 8 would have understood that profoundly, don't you think? He'd rescued her from a stoning. And in the end, he would realize that he died for her on the cross. And Jesus would go on to rescue anyone who could come to him. Rescue anyone from what we all deserve. We just got to come. That is the power. That is the wonder. And dare I say it, that is the sheer tolerance of the cross. And even more miraculous than that is that he did it for those who wanted to trap him as well. He died for the respectable religious hypocrites as much as he did for the terrified streetwise lowlife. Because Jesus isn't fussy. He knows what we're all like. He knows we're all on the wrong side of the line. And he loves us indiscriminately despite that. And that, I would suggest, is incredible tolerance. In fact, I go so far as to suggest that you will never find that sort of tolerance anywhere else. That's real tolerance. All I ask, if you're intrigued enough, is to follow your curiosity. Check him out, because there's always more to him than meets the eye. Ask your questions. Do the Christianity Explore course. But whatever you do, check him out. Follow your curiosity. Don't let this remarkable man just give you goosebumps. Let him also give you a new life. Let's pray. Then neither do I condemn you. Go now and leave your life of sin. Dear Lord Jesus, we are amazed by your tolerance. You do not tolerate things that should not be tolerated. And yet you are prepared to die on the cross in the place who do such things. That is amazing grace indeed. And we praise and thank you for it. Amen.